Historical Legalism, Galatianism. The second talk in a series titled Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity was presented by Ron Julian on January 16, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
So we're in the second week of our series on historical alternatives to Christianity. And for the first several weeks, we're going to be staying within the New Testament itself. One of the striking things, I think, about the story that you find in the Bible, starting in the Old Testament with the constant wandering and unbelief and misunderstanding of the Jews. But then you get into the New Testament, and the same thing is true with the churches. A lot of the letters that we read from the apostles are written to churches that, even though the apostles are there, and I mean they can get it right straight directly from them, still they go bad fairly quickly. So for a couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at various perversions that developed within the church at the time of the New Testament. And the advantage of that is that we get to have the apostles' commentary on it while it's happening. Tonight we're going to talk about legalism, which is an incredibly big theme in the New Testament. It's one of the biggest issues that gets discussed there, although of course the word is actually never used. Seems to me there are three major bodies of teaching in the New Testament that talk about legalism. In the Gospels, we see Jesus taking on the Pharisees. In Romans, we see Paul defending the gospel against the argument of Jewish unbelievers, Jews who were not buying the gospel, they didn't believe that Jesus was the Messiah, and they had their reasons for not believing it. And a lot of those reasons had to do with their essential legalism. In Galatians, we see Paul taking on the Judaizers. We are going to concentrate on Galatians tonight, on the issue in Galatians and what we see there. It seems to me that the book of Galatians makes a tremendous contribution to our understanding of the problem of legalism. Precisely because in the Gospels and in the book of Romans, we see Jesus and Paul dealing with out-and-out unbelief, people who were not accepting the idea that Jesus was the Messiah and legalism was at the heart of that rejection. But in Galatians, Paul is writing to people who are claiming to be believers, about people who are claiming to be believers. And yet, he's very severe in his criticism, and we're going to see that as we go along here. But that's what makes it so interesting, and I think ultimately instructive to us, because Galatians helps us to see clearly that the problem of legalism is not just a problem that's confined to somehow people who believe exclusively in the Old Testament or something like that. That you can believe in Jesus and yet be a legalist. And that's something that I think in our situation we really have got to understand. So that's my purpose tonight, is to try to understand the problem of legalism as we see it in the book of Galatians and try to get to the heart of what the problem is and what we need to be on the lookout for and what we need to be guarding against. So the big question is, what is legalism? And really, hopefully that's what I'm going to answer by the time we get done. The word legalism is not used in the Bible. It is a word that was coined later to describe a set of errors that Jesus and Paul in particular were fighting against. The kinds of issues that Paul's talking about in Romans and Galatians, and the kinds of criticisms that Jesus leveled against the Pharisees. People have taken those issues and said, well, here's a word that could describe that problem. Let's call it legalism. What's of concern to us is, what are the nature of those errors? What is it that's so wrong about being a legalist? Why was Jesus and why was Paul so harsh in speaking about these problems? I want to say right up front that it seems to me that there are some misunderstandings floating around about what legalism is and what it is we ought to avoid. For instance, it would be possible, because clearly some of the problem that Paul was addressing in Romans and Galatians had to do with the issue of freedom from the Jewish law, freedom from obligation to keep the Jewish law. So you might conclude, but it would be wrong to conclude, that if you are a person who doesn't believe that it is necessary to keep the Jewish law, then you're not a legalist. But that's not true. I mean, that's not necessarily true. Don't get me wrong. Another, clearly, part of the problem that Paul is addressing and that Jesus was addressing has to do with a kind of a rules-keeping mentality. You know, there's a certain set of rules and you got to keep those rules. But we would be wrong to conclude that avoiding legalism means avoiding all rules and all concern with doing what is right. Some people have extended this to the whole Old Testament. Basically, the Old Testament obviously represents one huge rule book that has now been thrown out, and we don't have to pay any attention to it anymore. And if I can say that I only read the New Testament, then by definition I'm not a legalist. Because legalists are people who read the Old Testament, obviously. And that's wrong perspective, I think. And it's clear that legalism, the problem that Paul is addressing there, is being contrasted with faith in Jesus, that faith is being offered as an alternative to this legalistic mentality. But it would be wrong to conclude that just because someone can say, I believe in Jesus, that they're not a legalist. So that's some of what we want to look at, some of what we can conclude about what the problem is and what we should be on our guard against as we look at the issue in Galatians. Now, there's no way in the world that I'm going to be able to give you an exegetical argument about what the entire book of Galatians is saying. But I do want to give you a little bit of background and just give you kind of a quick flash on what I think this book is saying, and then we have some other things we want to do here. But let me fill you in on the background, which many of you, I'm sure, are probably familiar with already. You may be aware that sometime after Paul's conversion to Christianity, he was called by Barnabas to go to Antioch here. This is the Mediterranean Sea. This is Israel down here, Judea. The Jerusalem is right there. And you may remember in Acts that it says that the believers were first called Christians at Antioch. Paul goes there. There's a predominantly Gentile church that Barnabas is leading and teaching, and he goes to get Paul, and together they lead this church for a while in Antioch. At a certain point, Paul decides to go on a journey, an evangelistic journey, and so he takes off from Antioch, comes down here to Cyprus, goes up into this region up in here, in the southern part of what we call Turkey now, Asia Minor, and preaches the gospel, starts churches in those various towns, and then comes back to Antioch. Okay? Now, after he gets back, it has come to the attention of the church in Jerusalem that Paul is teaching and doing these things, and there are certain Jewish Christians, part of the church community in Jerusalem, that come up to Antioch, and they also go to some of the places where Paul had started churches, and they basically go there with a message that, I mean, would be something like, well, you Gentiles have got a real good start here because you have agreed, as we do, that Jesus is the Messiah, and you're right about that. Now, what you need to do to find God's favor, obviously, is to obey the law that God gave. God gave a law through Moses, and now that you've recognized that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, you need to go all the way and be circumcised and eat kosher and so on. You need to become Jews. These are the folks that are referred to as the Judaizers, meaning they're trying to make Jews out of the Gentiles. They are trying to promote Judaism in the lives of the Gentiles. Paul deals with them in Antioch. They come to Antioch. There's a famous scene we'll talk about in a minute where even Peter gets a little afraid of these guys from Jerusalem and makes a mistake. Paul has to take him on about it. But Paul has come to understand that these guys have basically followed around in his tracks and gone to the churches that he has planted, and they're giving them there this message that they have to become Jews if they expect to enter into the Jewish salvation, the Jewish kingdom under the Jewish Messiah. And so Paul writes the letter of Galatians to these churches to counter what it is they've heard from the Judaizers. I should mention, by the way, that the chronology that I'm setting out here is actually debated. I mean, I should be honest about it. There's another theory about how all of this works, which I'm not convinced by. So I'm giving you one take on this, which I believe is the correct one. But you might find another reference book sometime describing this differently. Okay, at that point then, Paul writes his letter to the Galatians, and then, having written that letter, things really, you know, the water really gets to boiling, and finally it's decided that Paul and several others from Antioch should go to Jerusalem, should meet with Peter and James and the other leaders in the Jerusalem church and basically thrash this issue out. Paul's basically going there and saying, this is what I teach, this is what Jesus has told me, are you guys in agreement with me about this or not? And that's the Jerusalem Council that we see described in Acts 15, and the result of that is that the apostolic community joins together and in one voice says, yes, that's right. It is not necessary for the Gentiles to become Jews. Paul is right about this, Barnabas is right about this, and the Judaizers are wrong. And they write a letter to be sent to the Gentile churches that expresses the understanding of the apostolic community, that's the way it is. It is not necessary for you to take on the burden of living under the Jewish rituals. Okay? So that's the setup. The book of Galatians is written, as I understand it, right in the middle of this turmoil over this issue. These Jewish Christians, Christians in the sense that they believed that Jesus was the Messiah, insisting that a person couldn't be saved unless they actually became Jews in their practice. Okay, now, the book itself, if we were to very quickly describe what the message of Galatians is, how the book unfolds itself, it starts with Paul's telling the Galatians that they have been listening to another gospel, that this message that the Judaizers gave them is a perversion of the gospel that he preached, and it's such a perversion of the gospel that these ones who preached it should be accursed. I mean, he's very straightforward about that. He sees this teaching as pulling them away from the very gospel itself. He goes on then to talk about himself and his apostleship. Evidently, he felt the need to defend himself and his message to the Galatians. So what he tells them, basically, is, look, it's not as if I'm this guy who I hung around and I listened to Peter and I listened to John and some of the other apostles, and I decided it sounded pretty good, so I took their material and then I kind of threw in a few little pieces of my own to make it, you know, just to be original. That's not the way it worked. I learned this stuff from Jesus. I was chosen to be an apostle. He taught me what the gospel was about. And I haven't had all that much contact with the other apostles, actually. And he outlines, you know, I met him here, and I was 15 days here, but basically, look, I hardly know him. And, in fact, if you look at my dealings with them, we can conclude that they would agree with me on this issue. For instance, I took Titus, who was a Greek, with me the last time I visited Jerusalem, and there were some who tried to make trouble, tried to insist that he ought to be circumcised, but I held firm on that, and the other apostles, they didn't require him to be circumcised. They were with me on this. That brings him then, if he's talking about, I haven't depended on the other apostles, and they've agreed with me even, this brings him to one of the most striking instances of his interactions with another apostle. And this was in Antioch. It was that time I was telling you when some of the Judaizers from Jerusalem came up to Antioch. Paul describes that situation and says, look, they came there and Peter basically freaked out. He just got nervous. Here are these Judaizers saying that you've got to be Jewish in order to be saved, and he just didn't want to offend anybody, and he just felt nervous about the whole thing, and so Peter stopped eating with the Gentiles. And so Paul publicly basically calls him on the carpet and says, what do you think you're doing? And reminds him of the implications of the gospel that they're preaching, and the clear implication of that is that Peter agreed with Paul and recognized that he shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have stopped eating with the Gentiles. And in fact, if the chronology that I'm suggesting is right, we see later in Acts at the Jerusalem Council that Peter is one who stands up after Paul has given his testimony to what's been going on. Peter is one who stands up and says, that's right. That's exactly the way it is. So clearly by that time, Peter and Paul were of one mind as to how this stuff ought to work and its implications. Okay. Then, Paul goes into a description of a fairly difficult section to deal with, actually, where he's comparing the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant. That is, what God had promised to Abraham and then what God did with Moses in giving the law to Moses. And what he basically says is, look, the Gentile believers, through their faith in Jesus, have entered into the promises that were made to Abraham. And the Mosaic law that comes along later cannot come along and contradict the promises that God made to Abraham. God vowed, he promised that though, what he had said that he would do through Abraham and blessing the nations and so on, that's what he was going to do. And so the Mosaic covenant, the law, can't come along and put in some new rule that kind of blows the whole deal, because it would blow the whole deal, Paul's saying, because you cannot be justified by the law. You can't be right before God by the law. So if the law comes along and adds some extra condition to the Abrahamic covenant, then it blows the whole thing, because then the promise is null and void. It's not going to be available for anyone. He then uses a couple of vivid pictures to describe the freedom that the child of God has in relationship to the law. One of them is he pictures the law kind of like a part tutor, part slave master that mankind was under in its childhood. But now, in Christ, we have come out from under the tutor. We have come into the freedom of an adopted son. And we are heirs of the inheritance, the promise that God has made. And the law is no longer our master. We are not under servitude to the law the way at one time we were in our understanding. And then he paints another very strange picture where he goes to the story of Abraham's wife, through whom he has the child of promise, and Hagar, the maidservant, through whom another son is born who is not the child of promise. And he uses that he constructs this allegory, which I'm absolutely sure must have been tremendously offensive to his Jewish opponents, because what he does is to basically say, Hagar, the slave woman, she represents Israel. And the child, Isaac, born of the free woman, that represents the true church of God, the true people of God. But he's suggesting that to be under the law is to be like a child of Hagar, the slave, that to be under the law is to be a slave in a very real sense. And so he concludes then the book by talking about the freedom that comes through the gospel. The law cannot bring us to righteousness. It cannot bring us to that place where we are what we ought to be. And so in that sense, if we're under the law, we are still slaves. We are slaves to the law, but we are also slaves to our own flesh, because there's nothing else we can do. We can't get out from under our own problem. Christ brings true freedom, but this is not a freedom in the sense of I can just go do whatever I want. It is a freedom in the sense that I have been freed from the condemnation that I found under the law, and thus freed through the Spirit to live in a way that's in keeping with what God wants. It is a freedom from rebellion and unbelief. In a nutshell, that's what the letter of Galatians does. It takes the issue that the Judaizers have raised, says that what they have taught is a different gospel, and in various ways, practical ways, theological ways, it explores this issue of why it is that the law cannot justify us, and that to suggest that you have to keep the law in order to be justified with God is to pervert the gospel beyond recognition. That's what the book of Galatians, in a kind of a nutshell, does. Now, that's not enough. That little picture that I've painted there is not enough for us to really pin down what is legalism, what's the problem, and what should we do about it. So here's where the little handout that I gave you. I have a couple of potential, sort of taking a shot at, is this the problem of legalism? And I can tell you right now, the answer to each one of them is basically, no, it's not this. But these are potential answers that people might give as to looking at the book of Galatians, trying to understand what is the problem? What is he against? What's wrong with it? Okay, so hopefully this will become clear as we go along here, what the point is. I'm trying to basically triangulate on the problem. What is it exactly that legalism as a problem, as we see it in Galatians, what was the problem with it? One thing, that idea that we might get is that the basic problem with it is that the Judaizers were teaching that Gentiles should follow the Old Testament law. And that was their mistake. That right there is the problem of legalism in Galatians. That they were saying that the Gentiles ought to keep the Old Testament law, but in fact, they have no obligation to keep the Old Testament law, so that's a theological error on their part. They said yes when they should have said no. That's too simplistic an answer. And to demonstrate that, let me show you what I mean. We have what I would say is a similar issue in one sense in the New Testament regarding the issue of what is it that's acceptable for believers to eat. Because the Old Testament was filled with regulations that had to do with what can you eat, what's kosher and what's not kosher. And that represented a problem to Christians who were facing into now kind of the moral issues of what they ate. For instance, in 1 Corinthians, we're dealing with the problem of meat in the meat market that was sacrificed to idols. Should I eat it or not? To a Jew, it would be fairly obvious that the answer to that question is, of course not. I mean, that couldn't possibly be clean or kosher in the sense that they would have understood it. I also believe that the issue in Romans 14 is a similar kinds of issue, and I think it's based, I don't make that argument now, but I think it's based on an argument out of the Old Testament, how they would have understood what was appropriate to eat. In Romans 14 we read, "Now accept the one who is weak in faith, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on his opinions. One man has faith that he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats vegetables only. Let not him who eats regard with contempt him who does not eat, and let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has accepted him. Who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and stand he will, for the Lord is able to make him stand. One man regards one day above another. Another regards every day alike. Let each man be fully convinced in his own mind." And later he says, "Therefore let us not judge one another any more, but rather determine this, not to put an obstacle or a stumbling block in a brother's way. I know and am convinced in the Lord Jesus that nothing is unclean in itself. But to him who thinks anything to be unclean, to him it is unclean." Now, you can see, we have the issue of what is it's appropriate to eat. He also mentions, is every day alike or are certain days different? I mean, these are the kinds of issues that arise out of the Old Testament religion, something like the Sabbath or the dietary regulations, where the Christians at this time faced the question, well, look, God said this stuff. I mean, he had Sabbaths in the Old Testament. He has these dietary regulations in the Old Testament. He must have said that stuff for a reason, right? There must be some reason he gave that stuff. So we'd better do it. I mean, we want to be obedient. We want to be ethical, moral people. And God said to eat this way, so that's what we're going to do. And the problem that was created was that some people felt a freedom to ignore those regulations, and other people did not feel that freedom, and they followed them. Now, do you notice that there's actually not a whole lot of difference between that situation in one sense and the situation where some people think you need to keep the Mosaic law in being circumcised and what you eat and so forth, and others who'd say, no, you don't have to do that. Some people say we have a freedom to ignore that, and others would say, no, we don't have a freedom to ignore that, we're supposed to do it. But look at Paul's response to this issue in Romans 14. It is very, very, you know, oil on troubled waters, peacemaking. You guys get along with each other. Don't get on each other's case because you don't agree on this issue. Look, I happen to believe and know that it doesn't matter what you eat. But some of you believe that it does matter what you eat. And so for that person who thinks that it does matter what you eat, then you need to follow your conscience. And you need to, you who feel that freedom, you need to help them follow their conscience. Don't entice them into doing something that they think is wrong to do. So Paul's attitude is one of let's not judge one another and accept one another and so on. Now, the Judaizers, who basically were saying, you need to do this stuff, you don't have the freedom to ignore what it says in the Old Testament law, here's Paul's response to them in Galatians 1. I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another. Only there are some, the Judaizers, who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even though we, or an angel from heaven, should preach to you a gospel contrary to that which we have preached to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so I say again now, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to that which you received, let him be accursed. So we have these two very different responses to the issue of are you going to follow some dietary limitations or Sabbath days or something like that? Paul's saying, you guys, quit getting on each other's case, get along with each other, and so on. To the Judaizers who are teaching the Galatians, he's saying, you've corrupted the gospel, you know, you should go straight to hell. I mean, that's a very different sort of response. What I'm suggesting here is that it's not the issue in and of itself of whether you ought to keep the Old Testament law or not. The issue has more to do with the attitude that you bring to that question and why you would say you ought to keep the Old Testament law. With the issue of what they were eating that he's addressing in Romans 14, evidently nobody is saying you can't be saved if you eat a certain kind of meat. They were agreeing together, no, we're all believing in Jesus, we're all saved here, but what I do think is you're wrong to be eating that meat. You shouldn't be doing it. God doesn't want you to do it. So it's an ethical debate that they're having. What should we conclude about what is right and wrong in regarding eating and not eating when we look at the Old Testament and the precedent that comes before it? But in Galatians, the issue is, what does it take to be saved? What is it that characterizes the people of God? What's the difference between a believer and an unbeliever? And the Judaizers are saying, I don't care whether you believe in Jesus or not. If you're not obeying the law, then you are a rebel and an enemy of God, and you're not going to be saved. So it's that element that says, your salvation is dependent on your doing these things. That's the part that Paul is seeing as a corruption of the gospel. That's why the gospel itself is at stake. Just because the issue is, should you follow the Old Testament law or not, there are still two very different kinds of mistakes that could be made. Paul is not blasting the Judaizers because they're suggesting that the Gentiles ought to follow the Old Testament law. He's blasting them because they have perverted the gospel in the process. If in Galatians the issue were just my brothers, my fellow believers, I really believe that God gave us the sign of circumcision in the Old Testament because he meant for all his people to go through that, so I really think you ought to do it because God said to do it, that would be a totally different issue. Paul would come along and say, no, that's not right. You have misunderstood God's intentions. But he wouldn't be blasting them and saying, let them be accursed, because that would be a different kind of mistake. Now, we notice, okay, he didn't come down hard on the meat question, but he really came down hard on the circumcision question. Maybe circumcision somehow is a unique kind of error, which itself is somehow forbidden by the gospel. Maybe that's the problem, is that, no, you know, other issues regarding Old Testament law, it wouldn't matter so much, but circumcision, you can't get that one wrong. But the problem with that is another comparison that we can make. In Acts, we read, and he came also to Derbe and to Lystra, which is, this is Paul we're talking about, and behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek, and he was well spoken of by the brethren who were in Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted this man to go with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those parts, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. Now let's compare that with what we read in Galatians, where Paul says, but not even Titus, who was with me, though he was a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised. But it was because of the false brethren who had sneaked in to spy out our liberty, which we have in Christ Jesus, in order to bring us into bondage. But we did not yield in subjection to them for even an hour, so that the truth of the gospel might remain with you. So, I mean, what's the deal here? Here, on the one hand, Paul is saying, no way, I refuse to submit to this requirement that Titus be circumcised, and yet he himself instigates the circumcision of Timothy. So, is Paul a hypocrite? Does he not know what he's doing? I don't think so. But clearly, again, it's not circumcision itself that is the issue. It's the package that goes along with it. For Timothy, who was a half-Jew, his mother was Jewish, but his father was a Gentile, Paul wanted to take him with him. Well, what did Paul do when he went on his evangelistic journeys? The first place he went was to the synagogue in the town. Well, people, evidently Timothy was well-known enough to say, look, he's a Gentile. His father was a Gentile. And so Paul wanted to eliminate a potential source of problem. So he wanted Timothy to conform to Jewish requirement so that he could capitalize on his Jewishness. His mother was Jewish, and he could say, I am Orthodox and practicing in the way I conducted my life. I am Jewish. So I can come and talk to you and you can listen to me. So there, the issue was not Timothy's salvation. It was just, is Timothy going to be an effective evangelist along with Paul or not? But Titus was a Greek, and the Judaizers in Jerusalem were insisting that he be circumcised because they were saying he does not have the freedom to be uncircumcised. God said to do it, and he has to do it. And he will not be saved if he rebels against the law of God in this way. So again, the issue is very different. It's not circumcision itself. It could have been the other way around. It could have been that in the church that circumcision was an ethical debate, but the dietary regulations were the issue that somebody was pushing, no, you can't eat that. If you eat that, you will be condemned to hell. And so Paul's arguments would have been reversed. He would have said, let's be tolerant about the circumcision question, but don't let them tell you what to eat. Because what he's saying is, don't let anyone pervert the message of the gospel and the freedom that is inherent in the gospel. This is a fairly simple point, but is the error of legalism to rely on the Old Testament which has now been replaced with the New Testament. I put this in because there are those who will argue that that's the situation, that to look to the Old Testament for instruction or guidance is to somehow be going against what Paul was teaching in something like Galatians, and so we need to stay away from the Old Testament. And I just put in some passages here that it's striking how much Paul quotes the Old Testament in making the points that he's making, including that last one, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word in the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, which is a quote right straight out of the law of Moses. That's right out of Moses' mouth. So Paul is no opponent of the law in the sense that he believes that it is no longer relevant to us as believers. It's very relevant. The issue is we have to understand what's in the Old Testament and its purpose and significance. So the problem that the Judaizers had made was that in their legalism, in their self-righteousness, they had elevated certain parts of the Old Testament and given them a place that they didn't deserve. But the Old Testament itself is well worth appealing to. Isn't it? Well, I think it's likely, it's very possible and likely that the Judaizers would have been Pharisees. In fact, we know they were, because we're going to look at that. Yes, they were Pharisees. But what distinguishes them, what makes them a different group, is that typically when we talk about the Pharisees in the New Testament, they're opponents of Jesus and opponents of the gospel. But some Pharisees, like Paul, was a Pharisee. We have to remember, Pharisee does not mean bad guy. Pharisee is the name of a particular theological religious group in Israel, a religious party. And Paul was one of that party. And the Judaizers were Pharisees who came to believe in Jesus, who, instead of the other Pharisees who rejected Jesus, these were Pharisees who agreed that he was the Messiah. But they carried a lot of the Pharisaical mindset with them. And so they went as far as acknowledging that Jesus was the Messiah, but when it came to saying that a Gentile could be saved without becoming a Jew, that was too much for them. They're just not able to go that far. So yeah, that's the distinction. If you find yourself reading the book of Romans, it's helpful to remember that Paul's arguments there are directed against Pharisees who did not believe. In the book of Galatians, his arguments are directed against Pharisees who did believe in Jesus. And that accounts for some of the differences in the way he goes about it. Okay. Now, here's an interesting point, I think. If we try to understand the issue of legalism, a lot of the arguments that you find Jesus, you remember Jesus saying of the Pharisees that, you tithe dill and mint and cumin, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law. That idea that the Pharisees were concerned with ritual and the ritual requirements of the law, what you ate and what you wear and all that sort of thing, without being concerned the way they ought to have been with morality, with what's right and true and good, with justice and compassion and so on. And there's a certain element of truth to that. But we would make a mistake if we were to say that the error of legalism is merely to confuse ritual with morality. To say, no, see, your problem is that you're emphasizing that you have to be, in order to be saved, you have to, eat right and be circumcised and all of that. But instead, you ought to be emphasizing that in order to be saved, you have to do what is right. And be what is right, and That's not what Paul's argument is. That's not what he's suggesting. And I just pulled a couple of quotes out of Galatians here to show you the seriousness of the issue as Paul sees it. Let me just run some of these by you here. "Nevertheless, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but through faith in Christ Jesus, even we, you and I, Peter, have believed in Christ Jesus, that we may be justified by faith in Christ and not by the works of the law, since by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified." Okay, he sees it as being very seriously. You cannot be right before God on the basis of the law. But the question we might ask ourselves is it because that the law, as he's describing it, is too trivial to justify you? You know, so what's the matter if you eat kosher and are circumcised and that kind of stuff? You can't be justified by just keeping such trivial things. No, that's not his perspective. Notice the next one. Well, we have, "I do not nullify the grace of God, for if righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died needlessly." But then he goes on to say, "For as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book of the law to perform them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us." So you see, he sees it's not just that the law is too trivial to justify, it's the law is so weighty that we find ourselves under its curse and we need to be brought out from under it. And at the bottom of the page there we see, "Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? May it never be. For if a law had been given which was able to impart life, then righteousness would indeed have been based on law. But the Scripture has shut up all men under sin, that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe." So what I'm trying to emphasize here is that the problem with trying to be justified by the law is not that the law merely has trivial ritual demands that aren't enough to justify you. No, he sees the law as shutting us up under sin, that the law has a moral weight to it which we cannot match. We cannot live up to the standard that we find in the law, and so we're condemned by it. So the error of legalism is not just emphasizing ritual rules and so on, but it is to miss the moral weight of the law. In other words, to say, I've done what the law required. God said to do these things, and I've done it. And in doing that, to have totally missed how seriously and severely you have failed to live up to everything that the law represents. So, the error of legalism then has to do with, fundamentally, this, it's an issue of self-concept. How do I understand myself in relationship to the demands of the law? So yes, there is an element of ritual to it. I mean, Paul is arguing the rituals like circumcision and dietary regulations and so on, those are not going to justify you before God. But the reason is because you don't understand that you've looked at the law, filtered out a few rituals and said, I did it, and you've totally missed the fact that you haven't done it. If you're really going to talk about what it is that God would ask of a person to be right before him, that's not what you are. That's not what you've been. Okay, so we're kind of narrowing in now on what the problem is. There's another possible explanation that we might give. Is the error of legalism a failure to believe in Jesus? Because, now this would be a very easy thing to suggest, because if you look at Romans and you look at Galatians, what is it that Paul keeps saying is the alternative? We're not justified by the law, we're justified by faith. That's right. So if I just take that and run with it, I could say, okay, so that means then that in order to not be a legalist, you need to believe in Jesus. And therefore, if you believe in Jesus, then you're not a legalist. But that's an incorrect conclusion to draw, especially from the book of Galatians. That's why Galatians is so helpful. Because, notice, we'll quote this from Acts here first, and some men came down from Judea and began teaching the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Okay, these are men from Judea coming to Antioch. And when Paul and Barnabas had great dissension and debate with them, the brethren determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders concerning this issue. And when they arrived at Jerusalem, they were received by the church and the apostles and the elders, and they reported all that God had done with them. But certain ones of the sect of the Pharisees who had believed stood up, saying, "It is necessary to circumcise them and to direct them to observe the law of Moses." These Pharisees, who are described in Acts as being Pharisees who had believed, these are the very same ones that Paul is directing his curse at in the beginning of Galatians. Let them be accursed. Let them be anathema. He sees that unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved, as such a perversion of the gospel that it makes it another gospel. And not just that. I mean, clearly, Paul sees it not just as a theological error, but it's the kind of error that reflects what we could describe as an unregenerate heart. It describes a heart in rebellion against God, a heart that has not accepted the truth about its own sinfulness and so on. That's why he's saying, let them be accursed. I mean, he says, I don't care whether they believe in Jesus or not. This is not the gospel. This has nothing to do with what God has called us to. Notice how he says to the Galatians in chapter 5, "Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You have been severed from Christ. You who are seeking to be justified by law, you have fallen from grace." So, you see what I'm suggesting there. The Judaizers are those who believe, but Paul curses them. And the Galatians are those who have believed. He's writing to people who said yes when he proclaimed this and said, "Do you believe this?" And they said yes, and they got this church going. But what he's saying is, I don't care whether you believe what I've told you about Christ or not. Christ will be of no benefit to you. You can call yourself a Christian all day long, but if you listen to the Judaizers and say, "Yeah, okay, I get it. Yeah, I'll do the right thing and then God will accept me. I'll keep the law and on the basis of my performance of the law, God will accept me and give me salvation." Saying, if you listen to that and are circumcised on that basis, I mean, I don't think he's not saying that circumcision itself disqualifies you from salvation. In fact, later in Galatians, he says, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is anything. He says, that's not the issue. But if you listen to the Judaizers and essentially depart from the gospel I preached and believe another gospel instead, then Christ will be of no benefit to you. It doesn't matter that Christ is a part of that gospel that you're believing. A gospel that has Christ in it, but emphasizes your performance as the mark of whether you have been saved or not, your obedience to the ritual requirements of the law, that's a perversion and that's not a saving gospel. It doesn't matter whether you believe that because it's not true.
How has he said that?
He asked what danger is there in being a free will proponent or an Arminian. What will it do to your life systematically?
Right. Yeah, that's...
Is that where you're going?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say that the potential is there. It's actually a little more complicated than that, because I think, in my experience, I have met Arminians who understand the grace of God and Calvinists who do not. So I don't think it's as simple. You can't just equate it with the theological idea. But I think you could say that my sense of the biblical teaching is that that place for someone to come up against sort of the magnitude of how big God is and how much we need Him and how little of this really ultimately is in our hands, and to say, no, I don't buy that picture. I like the picture a lot better where I'm the guy who's calling the shots. There can be something incredibly rebellious and basically lacking that humility that marks, I think, true faith. But it's a little... You can't just equate, I don't think, the theology and the attitude, because... Well, in fact, I think we can say the same thing here in Galatians, because Paul is warning these people against listening to the Judaizers, but he's not assuming that they're going to listen to the Judaizers. I mean, he's sort of writing to them to sort out, are you in a place of theological confusion, or are you in a place of rebellion? And it's entirely possible to believe wrong stuff out of confusion. And I mean, it's sin that gets us there a lot of times, but it's not unbelief necessarily. But over time, I think, ultimately, our theology does come to represent, it does come to take on the shape of the attitudes that inform us. And that's what Paul's afraid of, is that their buying into this theological picture means that it's a picture that's attractive to them, because they basically think pretty highly of their abilities and a gospel that says, hey, you know, here's the rules, keep them and you're in. That sounds right. That sounds like the kind of gospel a guy like me ought to, you know, guy who can take it on and do the job ought to be believing in. So yeah, there is a kind of a similarity there, I think. Okay, so what I'm suggesting here is that it's crucial that we understand that the Judaizers and those in Galatia who were listening to them believed in Jesus. In the sense that, I mean, if you ever hear someone say that the gospel is Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus is the Christ. You know, in John, the Gospel of John, he says, I've written this that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ. And the issue is, you know, being saved, in that believing Jesus is the Christ so you can be saved. Well, a simplistic answer would be, okay, so if you believe Jesus is the Christ, that must mean you're saved. But that's what's striking, what's so helpful about Galatians, is these were Pharisees who believed that Jesus was the Christ. That's exactly what they believed. But they were cursed nonetheless, because they were legalists. They saw themselves as having met God's standard, and that's why God was going to ultimately save them. And they believed that Jesus was the Christ. We can see that. I threw in this last part here. When Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. Cephas, that's Peter we're talking about here. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision. And the rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in the presence of all, and really it's that one little phrase that I put all of that in there. He's accusing Peter of not being straightforward about the truth of the gospel. But Peter's not denying that Jesus is the Christ. He's not denying that he was raised from the dead. I mean, and he wouldn't have denied those things because he believed them. All he's saying is that Peter By your refusing to eat with the Gentiles, you have muddied the waters at a place where it needs to be clear. Because there's a part of the gospel that is being obscured by what you're doing. It's not the part about Jesus being the Christ. It's not the part about him being raised from the dead. It's not any of that stuff. It's the part about how nobody can stand before God because we're all sinners, and it is only the grace of God through the cross that is going to save you, and if you try to come to God on any other basis, you're not going to make it. That's the part, that's as much a part of the gospel as the rest of it. Yeah.
Is that any different than the Catholic saying that you've got to be saved by faith alone, through grace alone, and works?
I think it could be. There are, if we were to, let me put it like this. Is that any different than James saying we're justified by works and not by faith alone? Well, what James meant is not a problem. I mean, it's compatible, I would say, with what Paul is saying here. In fact, very compatible. They fit together. My best understanding, if I understand Catholic theology, is that what the Catholics mean by works in that situation is not compatible with what Paul is saying here. But I'm a little bit hesitant to say that because there's a lot of debates between Protestants and Catholics about whether or not that's in fact true. But my understanding, my best understanding, certainly historically speaking, if you look at the arguments that were made at the time of the Reformation, it seems very clear to me that Luther and Calvin and those guys were on the right side of this issue, and the Catholics were on the wrong side. The Pope and those at that time were.
But has anything changed?
Has anything changed? Well, I don't know. Maybe not.
So I understand the last confab they've had right recently, nothing changed. Along with that, in that doctrine, they still endorse that Second Council of Trent.
Yeah.
They said that anybody who believes that you're saved by grace alone through faith alone in Jesus Christ is anathematized.
Well, that sounds bad. I have to admit it. That sounds pretty bad.
Doctrine they still hold.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let me come back to that in my last comments here. Because that's an important question in a sense. I mean, there's something very important behind that. And it's my last little thing here will help to bring some of this out. Last error question here. Is the error of legalism insisting that believers must live obedient lives? And I would say, no, that is not the error of legalism. There is a sense in which a believer must be different than an unbeliever in the way he lives. And let's look, I got a couple of quotes from Galatians. Paul says, "For in Christ Jesus neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, but faith working through love. For you are called to freedom, brethren, only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another." And then finally he says, "Let us not lose heart in doing good, for in due time we shall reap if we do not grow weary. So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, and especially to those who are of the household of the faith." So Paul, I would argue in the context of Galatians, in the midst of the argument here, Paul is not simply urging them to pursue what is good. He is actually contrasting. There's the way that the legalist goes, and nothing good comes from that. Or there is the way that a believer goes, which is walking by the Spirit, and the result of that is faith working through love, we could talk about it. That the love is not an optional part of that picture. That as much as Paul emphasizes faith in Galatians, still, it is a faith working through love. It goes somewhere. It has a certain quality to it, or it's not really faith. Now, I mean, that's a topic we talk about a lot around here, but I can't, I mean, we're out of time, basically, and I can't explore that I can't defend that idea much. All I want to insist at this point is legalism as an error is not an error because it says you ought to do what is right. We should do what is right. And there is a very real sense in which someone who comes up against the question, should I do what is right? And they say, nah, I don't care about that. I'm just going to do what I want. There's a very real sense in which that can be the height of unbelief. That the way I have chosen to live can demonstrate that I in fact don't have the faith that Paul is describing here. So, let me try to sum this all up then. Having tried to come at it from various angles, what is it not? Let me just try to lay out here what is the problem. It seems to me that human beings, we have a very, very strong tendency towards self-justification. We want to be right in our own eyes. We want to be able to do what we want, but at the same time we're doing what we want to feel justified in doing what we want. Any religion, any set of religious practices provides an opportunity for self-deception and self-justification. Because, okay, it's a religious practice, it has to do with God and the favor of God, and here's the set of rules, and we're supposed to do these things, and so it gives me the opportunity to say, I know that I'm different than you because I do these things and you don't do these things. I can tell. All I have to do is watch. I can, you know, the good people, when they go by that little thing, they do something with their hands, or they kiss the little thing on the door, or, you know, whatever it might be. But the bad people, they go right by and they don't do it. So that's how I can tell the good people from the bad people. So I know I'm one of the good guys, and I can tell also that you're not. Legalism is a problem like this. It's taking a set of rules, a set of laws, some legal system, and denying the magnitude of my own problem by sort of distracting attention away from my real problem by pointing to my accomplishments in the religious area. Look at what I've done. It's kind of like, you know, the magician, the misdirection thing. You know, you're pointing over there while you're sticking something in your pocket or something like that. That's what legalism is. At heart, it is a lie. It is a lie that you're telling yourself, and it's a lie that you're telling other people, that I've done this right. I really have. When, in fact, the reality is that none of us have done this right. And if we don't understand that, then we don't understand the gospel. And it's usually accompanied by judgmentalism, because there's something, as much as I like to feel justified in myself, I can feel kind of a boost in that self-justification if I can kind of step on you on the way up. If I can feel better than you, you know, it's kind of like, you know, that thing in all of those army movies where they ask for a volunteer and everybody else steps backwards, and so that kind of leaves you in front. It's like that. I mean, if I can level out everybody else, then I'm tall. I'm the one standing up. Now, the Judaizers were those who balked at the justification by faith that was implicit in the gospel message. They wouldn't buy that. And because they wouldn't buy that message, they were showing their own self-righteousness, their own self-deception, that they really didn't understand their problem. They loved the rules because they thought that they were worthy before God because they kept them. It's very easy to feel that way. I mean, it is very easy to feel satisfied with yourself because of what you've done and superior to somebody else because of what you've done. That is an incredibly easy human trait to fall into. The problem was not with the Old Testament or with the law. The problem was with the attitude of the Judaizers, that they wanted to be able to think of themselves as being superior in that way. Now, what we can see here is that faith in Jesus was not enough. clearly one can believe many of the tenets of the Christian faith and still be a self-righteous legalist, because that's exactly what was true of the Judaizers. An implication of this, then, that we need to understand is that Christian religious practices can be just as seductive to a legalist as any others. The various traditions that we have as Christians are still, basically, in the end, a set of rules which is possible to embrace and say, I'm okay because I do them. Just like the rituals in the Old Testament could be misused that way, the rituals in the New Testament can be misused that way. If I think that in the end, if I have that sense that the reason I'm going to be accepted at the end is that because I'm different from everybody else, because I go to church on Sunday and they don't go to church on Sunday, and I got baptized and they didn't get baptized, and all that kind of stuff, then church, baptism, all that stuff has lost the significance that it has in the life of a believer. A believer goes to church because the believer wants to hear more about God and be taught about what's true and be reminded what's true so he can persevere in belief. A legalist goes to church because he likes to think of himself as a person who goes to church. He feels uncomfortable if he doesn't go to church because bad people don't go to church, and I don't want to be a bad person. I want to be one of the good guys. So, the issue of legalism relates to that self-deception. And that comes back then to my answer to your question about Catholic theology, is it seems to me the incredible contribution that Luther made when he looked at the Catholic doctrine that said basically that the righteousness of Christ has been infused into you. And so it is your merit, which God gave you. Jesus gave you this righteousness, but it is in the end your merit that's going to save you, because you've been made meritorious. Luther, in a sense, I mean, his great contribution was that he was such a miserable sinner that he couldn't buy it. I mean, he look at that and say, as he said, I could come to know assurance that God was going to accept me on the basis of my merits, because I just couldn't find those merits. And his coming to see that Paul was describing justification as being a gift from God, that it was in spite of our lack of merit, and we don't have to become meritorious in order to be justified. We're justified immediately. Before there's anything good about us, we're right with God. His recognition, his recognition that was true was a great leap forward. For him personally, it was very important, I think, because what's significant about that is his honesty about his own situation, where three monks along the road next to him could buy this doctrine and say, yeah, it sounds right to me. You know, Christ's made me good, and when I get there, I'm going to be rewarded for how good he made me. The problem is that they're self-deceived, because they don't realize that they're not nearly as good as they think they are. So that's where the danger in that kind of theology can be. But I could imagine someone who would understand Catholic doctrine in a different way, who would recognize their own sinfulness, but see that that God really has changed something about them, and that they're a different person than they used to be in their faith and belief and so on. I could imagine that such a person could take Catholic doctrine, and they couldn't take it consistently. I mean, it wouldn't exactly fit all that's taught, but then I don't think what you always hope for us as believers is that we will all live inconsistently with our bad theology. To the extent that our theology is not so good, our hope is that what we're living is better than what we're saying. So, yeah, I think that the Catholic doctrine on justification and that stuff is dangerous. It could easily promote the kind of self-deception that Paul is crying out against in Galatians.
It seems to me like, where did purgatory come from? And it seems to me like if you follow their reasoning, that of course you have to accept Jesus Christ,
right,
and faith. I don't exactly know how they work that in there when they say works also.
Right.
But it seems to me like following that on out and the thinkers, they would say that it's obvious, as what Luther came up against. He says, there's not any good thing in me. That's the way he saw it. And he knew he had evil thoughts continually. He couldn't get away from them. And couple that with the ones that they declare to be saints and canonize, which are mighty few.
Mm-hmm.
And so here they have the vast hordes of Catholics who die and have not done consistent
right.
good works.
Right.
Have to be canonized.
Right.
And they say that they don't know if they're saved. First, they have to go to purgatory.
Right.
Well, if they didn't go to purgatory, there's only one other place left.
Right.
That's right, straight to hell.
Right.
And you can't be bought back out of hell.
Right.
Therefore, they had invented purgatory for the masses to go to, and then they invented their ways to get them out, flowers on the grave, consistently, prayers,
right.
money, money, money.
Right. Right.
And then they can be taken out of
right.
purgatory and go to heaven.
Right.
So
you're right. There's a consistency there.
And boy, oh boy, you have to start.
Right. Right.
Well, the basic foundation of the Roman Church has been to. It starts out with you either accept us, you have to be a part of us, and then from there you have to accept what we teach. And then all the ritualism in which follows.
Yeah.
But of course, the Protestantism, I mean, the Protestant Church has basically done a lot of the same things, too.
Yeah.
But that's a whole different.
Right. So. Right. Let me make one last comment then. And I'm sorry, we're late, but I'll make one last comment and then we're done. I want to emphasize, on the other hand, that a concern for righteousness and what is right is not legalism. There is a moral revolution that is brought about in the life of a believer. It has to do with what Paul describes as walking by the Spirit. That it is not legalistic to believe that a believer must show some inclination toward and desire for what is good, or it's unlikely that that claim to faith is a real one. The key to all of it is that we be honest about how much we fail. The key to the gospel is to understand that we are always receiving mercy, not justice. I am not getting justice. I've been a believer for, 25 years? I'm still not getting justice. I had better not get justice. And if I go another 25 years, I still am hoping for mercy and not justice. However much we may mature and grow and so on, the fact is that we are not getting there on our merits, and not on our merits back then and not on our merits now. We have to be honest about that, to see where we are before God. That's the problem with legalism, and that's why it's hit so hard in the New Testament. Legalism is always self-deception about my own moral condition. That's what fuels legalism. And that's the problem. Not mistaking which rules you're supposed to keep and which ones you're not supposed to keep, but it's that dishonesty, that self-deception about your own moral condition, that's the sting at the heart of legalism. And that can be true in Christianity as much as in anything else. Okay, we're done. Thank you.